Hello, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's Today's Topics in Health Disparities. I'm Marcia Lilly Blanton, Senior Advisor on Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare at the Foundation. For those of you who have not joined us for a prior discussion, Today's Topics is an interactive, live webcast series that addresses issues relating to disparities in health and healthcare in the U.S. The goal is to raise the level of understanding of these disparities and encourage greater dialogue about the problems and promising solutions. Today's topic, Immigration and Healthcare, What Are the Policy Choices?, examines the influence of immigration policies on federal and state decisions about access to health coverage and care. We also will discuss the potential impact of these decisions on disparities in care. These are controversial and complicated issues. So to assure that we have some common understanding, I'll start with a few facts key to this conversation. While it is not well known, undocumented immigrants have generally been restricted from enrolling in Medicaid since the program's inception in 1965. A more recent federal law barred legal immigrants from enrolling in Medicaid during their first 5 years in the U.S., and Congress in 2005 added strict citizenship documentation requirements for enrolling in Medicaid. In response to these shifts in federal policy, some states and local governments have begun using their own funds to address the health coverage and care needs of their growing immigrant populations. Immigrants are currently estimated to represent 13% of the U.S. population. Roughly half of U.S. immigrants were born in either a Central American, South American, or Caribbean country, and about a quarter come from a mix of Asian countries. In the U.S., immigrants from these countries typically are racially or ethnically classified as Latino, Hispanic, African American, or Black, or Asian, and they generally live in communities that predominantly include families of these racial ethnic groups. As such, issues of immigration become intertwined with discussions about the challenges communities of color face in obtaining timely access to health care. The issue of immigration policies and healthcare is complicated because it is in part shaped by an undercurrent of discussion that reflects U.S. workforce issues as well as a broader set of issues that arise from racial ethnic stereotypes, prejudices, misconceptions, and a history of unequal opportunities for communities of color. These are not the primary issues we'll discuss today, but we also will not ignore them should they arise. In our studio today, we have two distinguished guests whose bios are on our website. We're pleased to have with us Tom Perez, Secretary of Labor, Licensing and Regulation in Maryland, and the former Director of the Office of Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and Leighton Koo, Professor of Health Policy, the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Thank you both for joining us. Let me also say to our audience that we had expected to have Steve Camarota with us today. Unfortunately, he is very ill and sends his regrets. Before I turn to our panelists, let me remind our audience that we welcome your questions. So email us at todaystopics@kaisernetwork.org. That's todaystopics, one word, at kaisernetwork.org. Leighton, I'd like to start with you. How would you describe the estimated 37 million immigrants in the U.S. today in terms of country of origin, years in the U.S., as well as legal status?
Sure. Well, as you already mentioned, immigrants come from a diversity of countries. About half of the current immigrants come from either Mexico, Central America, or South America. About a quarter come from Asia. And then the balance come from Europe, Africa, Canada, wherever. About two-thirds of the immigrants, and by that I mean anyone who's foreign-born, about two-thirds of them are relatively established, have been in the U.S. for 10 years or more. About a third are more recent immigrants. And so those who are here for the longer time, the majority of them actually become naturalized citizens. When you look at the more recent immigrants who've been here, say, 10 years or less, there you're dealing with a mix that is predominantly legal permanent residents, that is, green card holders, or those who are undocumented. And then there's smattering of people that we sometimes call temporary visitors, people who are visa holders who are coming here on a work visa or a student visa. All told, thinking about legal status, about a third of all the immigrants in the U.S. are naturalized citizens, about a third are undocumented, and about a third are legal permanent residents in some manner, shape, or form.
And Tom, why do most immigrants come to the United States?
For a better life. Mm-hmm. I live in Maryland. In my county, the influx of immigrants, the most recent influx of immigrants, was a result of the war in the mid-80s in Central America. A lot of people were displaced in El Salvador, in Guatemala, other Central American countries by the political unrest, and so they came here. Mm-hmm. And so I think the immigrant story today or 100 years ago or 150 years ago is a similar story, which is people seeking a better life, and then people bringing family members over, and people enriching our communities by bringing that expertise and work ethic to our communities.
Why is this issue seemingly more in the news?
Well, I mean, this is an issue. There's a certain Groundhog Day quality to the immigration issue. I mean, you look at the history of our country, and there have, on seemingly regular intervals, been conversations about immigration. The Know Nothing Party in the early 20th century, a lot of conversation about immigration, whether it was Irish immigrants or Italian immigrants. Today, the focus is on Latinos. 20 years from now or 30 years from mm-hmm. now, one thing is certain to me is that there's going to be another conversation about immigration. The only thing I'm not certain about is what will be the continent or country of origin. Mm-hmm. And so while this issue has come up, and one reason that I think it comes up right now is when you have economic unrest, I think there's often a tendency to look for scapegoats. And right now in some communities, I think immigrants are a rather convenient scapegoat to blame one's problems on. Mm-hmm. And so, there is that Groundhog Day feel to this, and regrettably that's...
Some would argue, or have argued, that we have mm-hmm. a new influx in part because of the demands of the workforce. Is that your sense, or is that not the case? Is it largely what's happening in other countries versus what's happening in our country?
Well, I think the reasons for people coming are very complex, mm-hmm. and oftentimes depend on perhaps what region of the world you are emigrating mm-hmm. from. I'm very familiar with the statistics in Maryland. We currently have 400,000 immigrants in Maryland. 400,000 immigrants working mm-hmm. in Maryland. And it's a very interesting demographic mix. Mm-hmm. 43% of that population of immigrants working in Maryland has a college degree or above, compared with 36% of native-born Marylanders. Mm-hmm. To put it slightly differently, we currently have a lot of underemployed immigrants who are sweeping floors, driving cabs, even though they were trained as healthcare providers mm-hmm. in their country of origin. And so, I think one of the things we've learned from this study of the supply side on the immigrant front is that, where would Maryland be without, where would the National Institutes of Health be without immigrants? They would be in big trouble. Mm-hmm. Where would the healthcare profession be mm-hmm. without immigrants? Mm-hmm. Big trouble. Where would the service sector be? Where would the Eastern Shore mm-hmm. of Maryland and the poultry industry, the hospitality industry, where would they be without immigrants? And so immigrants are an integral part of our workforce, and it's not simply the low-wage service sector. It is anywhere from the National Institutes of Health to the hospitality sector.
Right. We actually got a question about immigrants in the workforce and in the healthcare system, mm-hmm. but I'll come back to that one because we're going to focus on that a little bit more. But I wanted to ask, before we go to focus on health, is this an issue that is more of a concern to some states than others? Immigration policies,
sure, it changes. I mean, immigrants tend to be most concentrated in a handful of states like California, Texas, New York, that are the traditional immigrant states. Mm-hmm. But oddly enough, those are not necessarily the states where immigration has become politically the hottest issue. Mm-hmm. What's happened in the demography over the past decade or so is that immigrants have tended to shift away from those traditional gateway states mm-hmm. towards a whole band of states that sort of sweeps from the south up through the Midwest, up into the northwest corner of the U.S., states that traditionally didn't have many immigrants, now that have seen their populations double, in some cases triple or quadruple over the past decade or so. In many cases, those are the states that are seeing the greatest controversy about immigration because it's a sudden change that's occurred where people are now saying, gee, my neighbors are not the same neighbors that I used to have. Something is changing in my neighborhood, and sometimes it's good. It means that we've kept the factory in business. It means that we're building new homes. On the other hand, sometimes people are concerned that, gee, now my children are going to schools and there are lots of kids who speak Spanish.
Actually, and in my opening remarks, I mentioned that about 3 out of 4 immigrants would be classified in the U.S. as Latino or Hispanic or Asian. Does that affect people's attitudes about the immigrant population and their either education or health care needs? I mean, is that at all an issue?
We have a slightly different profile in Maryland, so I was processing your question through the lens of Maryland, which is actually has a lower Latino population, and they're mostly from Central America, not from Mexico. So it's a very interesting demographic mix. I think Layton's right on the mark. I mean, this issue has arisen in Iowa, in Nebraska, the meatpacking industry. The 96 immigration bill, Senator Grassley of Iowa inserted a provision to give local law enforcement the authority to enforce immigration laws because he wanted to deputize authorities in Iowa, given the demographic changes in that state. So when you look at that, the profile that you tend to see most frequently on television is the profile of Latinos right now. Mm-hmm. But again, looking at this from a historical perspective, a century ago it was Italians or Senator Kennedy I used to work for, and he had that famous sign in his office, Irish need not apply. Mm-hmm. And so, today it may be disproportionately tensions that are directed at Latinos, but depending on what corner of the country you may be in, that may be different right now, and that will undeniably be different in the next wave of conversation.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let's shift the conversation a little bit to talk about both health and health care. What do we know about the health of immigrants who are coming to the U.S., particularly recent immigrants? And what do we know about what happens over time?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on what you mean by health. Mm-hmm. In general, in terms of the standard things that we mean by health status measures, immigrants actually tend to be relatively healthy, particularly when they come to the U.S. Among other things, if you're coming in as a legal immigrant, there are actually certain screens. If you're coming in with certain sorts of disabilities or with communicable diseases, you can't legally immigrate to the U.S. If you're coming in as an undocumented, to be perfectly honest, the undocumented know they're coming for hard physical work. Right. If you're disabled or sick, you're not going to try to come to the United States. What the studies also tend to show is that over time, paradoxically, immigrants tend to become somewhat less healthy and become more like citizen Americans over time. Part of this is because they have poor access to health care. I mean, that's the other distinguishing feature about immigrants is they have very low insurance coverage rates, very poor access to health care. Right. Many cases the health care they get is of poor quality as well. So some of these factors, along with sort of other cultural factors that happen over time, mean that immigrants tend to become less healthy over time.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the issue of disabilities, and one of our questions is about immigrants who are illegal and disabled. So let me just read the question while we're at this point. It says, what are the options for people with identifiable disabilities who are illegal immigrants in our nation? Do they have any, or are they sent back to their country of origin? If they are displaced people with disabilities, are there options available to help them? I know that's a fairly detailed question, but
I mean, in some contexts, what ends up happening is an illness will manifest itself, become emergency, and then you might be able to access care through emergency Medicaid, because as our listeners probably know, emergency immigration status is not a condition precedent for the receipt of emergency Medicaid. But In reality, in the communities that I'm familiar with, there's an informal network of free clinics, and it's very much catch-as-catch-can.
Mm-hmm.
There are some jurisdictions, the jurisdiction I live in, the county government has invested a significant amount of money in providing a safety net for the uninsured. It's a rather perverse state of affairs where the county government is the safety net as opposed to the feds or the state setting in. But it's very much catch as catch can. And it's going to be a function of where you live and what sort of informal networks of free clinics exist. And that's a very unsettling answer for people because it will absolutely be a function of dumb luck, you know, the geography of where you happen to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say the other thing that happens is this is also where we see some of the most unfortunate and probably cruel paradoxes in the way that we treat immigrants. As Tom mentioned, many immigrants, if they're poor and they're disabled, even if they're undocumented, may be eligible for emergency Medicaid. So they may get an initial treatment if they have kidney disease. They may be able to go in and immediately be seen in the emergency room, but they may have problems if they need ongoing dialysis for their kidney disease,
mm-hmm.
or if they need ongoing chemotherapy because they have cancer. At that point, oddly enough, it's no longer considered an emergency,
right.
and in many cases, emergency Medicaid may be lost, and there may be a problem that either the hospital or the clinic continues to provide fairly expensive care for this immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, many of them continue to do so. But in some cases, they say, gee, we can't afford to.
Right.
And then this immigrant can't get access to therapy that's available that works to keep them from getting sicker.
Why don't we step back a little bit, because we haven't really talked about insurance coverage. And I think it'll be helpful to make sure our audience understands what we know about the insurance coverage of both legal and illegal immigrants. There were changes in federal law that actually barred legal immigrants from receiving coverage. So if we could just have a sense from what exists now, what's available, and what do we know about coverage rates.
Sure.
Do you want to
talk about Medicaid?
Sure.
Why don't you do that, and then I'll talk about some of the examples in Maryland that augment it.
Okay.
Sure.
Marcia, as you mentioned at the beginning, the undocumented are generally speaking not eligible for Medicaid at all except for emergency coverage. Legal immigrants are not eligible for federal coverage if they've been living here for less than 5 years. On the other hand, a number of states, slightly less than half the states, have some state-funded coverage. So states like Maryland actually say, no, we disagree with this federal policy. We're going to step in with federal funds to help fill that gap. On the other hand, there are many immigrants who don't qualify for Medicaid because, for example, if they're childless adults, they still wouldn't qualify for Medicaid, and then they're not going to get that public coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the big gaps, to my mind, for immigrants are not so much public coverage as private coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Their studies repeatedly show the real underlying problem ends up that even though immigrants predominantly are working, they are much less likely to be offered health insurance by their employers. When it's offered to them, they'll take it up at about the same rates as citizen workers, but they're less likely to be offered
and
health insurance in the first place.
They're in the service sector. They're in the industries that are the lower wage industries that are much less likely to offer that coverage.
And there may be some extent to which there may be some exploitation that's associated with immigration status that's playing a part of it also. But the net result is where some of the real gaps are, both public coverage, but there are big gaps in private coverage too.
Right.
Nonetheless, I mean, I think one of the things that's important to note is that a fairly large proportion of immigrants do have private health insurance. And so every now and then people think, oh, immigrants in general, particularly undocumented, they're always all uninsured. And that's, like so many things, an overgeneralization.
Right.
Many immigrants have private insurance, not enough of them, wish it could be a lot more, but nonetheless many do. Many, particularly those who are legal immigrants who have been here for more than 5 years or naturalized citizens, are eligible for Medicaid, should avail themselves of the purposes for those things if they're eligible and they need health care. But for the rest, there are some real gaps.
And as Layton correctly said, a number of states have indeed attempted to pick up the slack. In Maryland, where I live, they made the decision in the mid-90s after immigration reform to provide with state-only dollars coverage for pregnant women and children. Mm-hmm. And but what you're seeing also now is, and this isn't a trend that's not limited to immigrants, but as state budgets shrink, there are always efforts afoot to make eligibility more difficult. Again, not for including, but not limited to immigrant populations. And some of the things that are being done are, in my judgment, regrettable but legal. Mm-hmm. Other things are, I think, regrettable and not legal. Mm-hmm. And an example of the second category was a number of states that were, as a condition of receipt of Medicaid or SCHIP, requiring proof of the immigration status of the entire family as opposed to the individual applicant. The only relevant question as it relates to immigration status is the applicant, him or herself. And frequently in the SCHIP context, you have citizen children living in mixed families. And the only relevant question is the citizenship of that child. But frankly, I think many states were implementing this knowing full well that once that question was asked, it was going to chill participation. Mm-hmm. So we need to be very mindful state regulators and people, advocates that are concerned with accountability, of ensuring that as states attempt to cut corners, that they're not running afoul of civil rights and other laws.
We actually got several questions about the citizen documentation requirements, and one of the questions, and I'll just read one, asks whether or not those documentation requirements are actually jeopardizing legal immigrants getting access to Medicaid and other programs. Do we have any evidence of the spillover effect?
Well, certainly the most recent efforts. It's not simply legal immigrants that were affected, but U.S. citizens that were affected, because the documentation of citizenship sounds like something that only affects people like my parents who emigrated here, but it affects so many people, because people, you know, who were born and raised in the U.S., proving that can be very, very elusive. Mm-hmm. So the recent Deficit Reduction Act requirements, I think, had a remarkably unfortunate residual consequence of lowering participation among people who were absolutely eligible, U.S. citizens, legal immigrants, and otherwise eligible immigrants.
I'll say this was one of the things that I think was most peculiar and unfortunate about those changes under the Deficit Reduction Act, was that it's always been the case that, or I wouldn't say always, but before this was certainly the case that if you were coming to Medicaid and you were an immigrant and you were applying for Medicaid, you already had to show documentation that you were a legal immigrant, whether that meant that you had to show your green card or other form of evidence that you were a legal immigrant. So those who were coming to Medicaid as immigrants actually were already having to prove their status for the undocumented eligible for emergency Medicaid. Obviously, there's no documentation there to be provided. This provision only applied to people who were saying they were citizens. Mm-hmm. So, in principle, it should not have affected legal immigrants who were trying to get Medicaid services. Should have only been applying to citizens, and there is a fair amount of evidence that enrollments in Medicaid fell and primarily did affect citizens. Not immigrants. On the other hand, there were many people who thought that it could affect immigrants, legal immigrants, because in many cases the news that was going out was everybody who's applying to Medicaid, you must show your citizenship. And so then many cases, people who were legal immigrants might mishear that message or misunderstand the message and think, gee, I'm not eligible at all, or my child's not eligible. And that was a misconception. Many states tried to clarify that. I certainly know a number of immigrant groups were trying to clarify that message, but it's easy to believe that there was some confusion.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the uninsured, because that's the issue that certainly has risen to the top of the presidential campaign and is certainly a part of major discussions. There's some who argue that the rise in the immigrant population has very much shaped the rise in the uninsured population. What evidence do we have about the impact of immigration on the rate of uninsured?
When we look at census data or other sources of information, we see that, for example, between 2000 and 2006, the census data say that there was about a 9 million increase in the number of people who were uninsured. The people who were anti-immigrant would tell you, so it's mostly the immigrants. That's what was causing it all. In fact, when you look at the information, a relatively small fraction of that increase, about 2 million or so, a little bit less than a quarter, occurred among non-citizen immigrants. Three-quarters of the increase in the number of uninsured was occurring among native citizens. So primarily, the problem of rising numbers of uninsured is primarily a problem that's afflicting citizens in the U.S. and not immigrants at all. In fact, if you look over that same time period, actually there was, relatively speaking, a slight gain in the proportion of immigrants who were having insurance coverage. So during the past several years, immigrants were actually faring slightly better, relatively speaking, than citizens. So it really is a trivial factor as far as the problems. The problems in general that affected immigrants were similar to the problems that affected citizens, which is to say, healthcare prices were going up, insurance premiums were going up. In some cases, states were reticent to step in and pick up additional coverage under Medicaid or CHIP.
Employers are not covering. You know, you look at in the Kaiser Commission, and the foundation does a great job of tracking employer-provided coverage. It's moving in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. That's looking over time. Let's take a snapshot in time. The Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and Uninsured estimates that immigrants account for about a quarter, a little less than a quarter, of the uninsured. There are some who argue that that is disproportionate to their size in the population. How do you respond to those concerns about the point-in-time estimates?
It's true that that immigrants are disproportionately uninsured. So, yes, it's a particular problem. Some of the reasons for why they are a disproportionate share of the uninsured are things like the immigrants tend to be a greater share of the low-income population, and the low-income population is where you see a substantial portion of the uninsured. And then some of it is the other factors that we talked about, the types of jobs that immigrants often have that mean that they're not offered private health insurance, and then the fact that they're not offered public health insurance in many cases either. All these things add up to a result that many immigrants are disproportionately uninsured. Still, that's not the major source of the increase in the number of uninsured.
One of our questions asks, what's the responsibility of employers in terms of offering coverage or providing coverage? I mean, if they're bringing people here to work, do they have a responsibility to make sure that people are not without the coverage that they need?
Well, I would like to think so. I would think that issue transcends the issue of immigration. I mean, that's I think a broader policy question about employer-based coverage. And we're seeing again, as we move, as the nation transforms to more of a service economy, this is one of the basic questions being asked: is what are the responsibilities and of employers and the whole conversation about globalization is in part a conversation about how do we avoid what some would call this race to the bottom. As wage pressures increase, the pressure to cut benefits, and starting with healthcare benefits, rises. So I don't frame that issue simply in the context of the immigrant workforce. I would frame that issue writ large, and so that really is an enormous issue.
One of the questions we have also asks whether or not efforts to expand coverage have actually attracted undocumented immigrants. Is there any evidence that efforts to expand coverage in particular states is actually attracting new immigrants to those states?
I find it very far-fetched, I guess. The notion that a person is sitting in rural Mexico reading the paper saying, hey, Montgomery County, Maryland is now offering the consular identification card for people living here. You know, let's all get on the bus and move to Montgomery County, Maryland. That is not what drives people to leave their countries of origin. It's a much different set of dynamics and involving, you know, the desire for a better life, the fact that you have relatives in a certain area. Why do we have so many Somali immigrants in the Twin Cities? And you know, that was an initial entry point, and then word of mouth got people and built that population in the Twin Cities. So when I hear some of the explanations for policy initiatives designed to affect access to benefits, and I hear the justification that this will ensure that people don't come here, it just reflects a naive understanding. Naive is really a charitable term, an incorrect understanding of what drives these decisions.
Well, let me just add, first of all, Tom's right. I mean, the reason immigrants move, whether from another country to the United States or within the United States from one state to another, primarily is for a better life, in many cases because of either employment opportunities or because of their families located. But if you think about it, I mentioned earlier that there's been a change in the location of immigrants over the past decade. They've tended to move from states like California and New York that we traditionally think are the more generous states in terms of benefits in general, but also benefits for immigrants, and then toward states like southern states or some of the states in the Midwest. These are some of the states that are the least generous. So if nothing else, the evidence of the pattern shows that where immigrants are moving actually are to states with less generous benefits. I don't think it's that they're moving there because the benefits are less generous, but because the thing that's really important to them was this was where they thought there were jobs in construction and meat or poultry processing. That's where they thought there were opportunities to make a livelihood and to be independent.
Let's talk a little bit about where care is provided and the type of care that's available and provided. There's several concerns about whether or not immigrants are getting the timely care they need, in part linked to the lack of coverage. What do we know about the safety net providers or the access to services that are now available to immigrant populations?
Well, there's not enough, and it tends to be catch-as-catch-can. And again, some communities, you have a pretty robust network of free clinics, nonprofit providers, but it's to call it a patchwork would be, I think, an accurate statement. And as a result, you know, there's often certain locations that bear a disproportionate brunt of the caseload. Access to dental care is virtually non-existent. Access to specialty care, which is a problem for Medicaid populations generally, is an acute problem in the immigrant context. And I think the absence of general preventive care is why you see the phenomenon that Leighton described earlier in this show, which is that immigrants come here and they're healthy, and over time you see higher incidence of need for health care because there isn't the preventive maintenance going on.
We have a question that actually came in from Ghana that asked, do immigrants pay for health services or do they depend on the federal government? And I think we've answered this in different ways, but I think it does reflect a concern that some people has. Who pays for the care that immigrant receives?
Generally speaking, most of the care that immigrants receive, they're paying for themselves or is being paid for through private insurance that either they or their employers are picking up the cost for. There is some picked up by the government, but that's true for citizens as well. Again, immigrants actually are underrepresented in terms of reliance on public insurance, things like Medicaid, and even Medicare, I should say, add as well. Immigrants in some cases are able to get charity care from safety net facilities, but that adds up to a relatively small share. So what you see is that immigrants get less care in general, pay for a larger share of their care out of their own pocket because they don't have health insurance. So it's a mixture of things. Immigrants often do have to pay for care themselves, but because they don't have the health insurance, their dollars don't stretch as far as the dollars for people who have health insurance.
Let's talk about some of the state initiatives. Leighton, I know you did a study looking at what states were now accepting the federal provision that allows them to enroll pregnant women in the CHIP program. How does that vary across the U.S. in terms of state efforts?
It varies tremendously across the U.S. Slightly less than half the states, my recollection is it's something like 22 states, will use state funding to cover children in either Medicaid or CHIP, despite the fact of the lack of federal matching dollars. So this is something where the states have gone to special efforts and have basically picked up some of the costs that traditionally the federal government used to be a partner on. A fairly large proportion are providing some form of care for pregnant women who are legal immigrants. Some states even provide coverage for legal immigrants, for undocumented pregnant women, mm-hmm. realizing that when their children are born, their children are going to be citizens of the U.S. There are still larger gaps when you're talking about other adult populations. But so many states have, the majority do not provide those sorts of coverage under Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. And what about health professionals? We've got several questions from clinicians who are concerned about the cost that they bear when immigrants don't have the resources to pay for their care. Is there a sense that this is a problem that states are trying to address? Are there different providers who are more open than others?
Well, we're all a function of our own experiences and mm-hmm. looking across Maryland. We have a pretty robust network of mm-hmm. Providers in my neck of the woods. And we also, one thing that, and this is harder to capture in some of the data that Layton attempts to capture, there's a lot of county and city investment. As a result of the whole devolution movement and the retreat at a federal and oftentimes at a state level, counties have indeed stepped to the plate. So, for instance, there's a program in Montgomery County where I live where we, pregnant women, where the county and two hospitals are funding the prenatal care, and then the labor and delivery is funded through emergency Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so that was an effort to prevent the situation where the first contact was when somebody was 8.5 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so I would add to the mix in this, I think, a number of local jurisdictions that have really, I think, stepped to the plate in meaningful ways to address the safety net. And one of the things that, in terms of the research agenda, I'd like to see more efforts to document the role of local jurisdictions mm-hmm. and safety mm-hmm. net providers, because we sometimes ignore that group of, I think, increasingly involved and active mm-hmm. Providers.
We got several questions about from North Carolina and Georgia, some of the newer states.
Sure.
And one question is, Georgia has introduced and passed very serious anti-immigrant laws. Do you think this creates a situation where immigrants are so scared that they hesitate going to the emergency room?
Yes. I mean, one of the challenges we had when I worked in the Clinton administration was there was so much fear and misinformation about what you could and couldn't access mm-hmm. That immigrants were afraid to access Medicaid and other services for which they were eligible because they were fearful of becoming, quote-unquote, a public charge mm-hmm. and therefore jeopardizing the application, either their own application for citizenship or the application of a family member. And so we actually put forth a very aggressive initiative of education and outreach so that people understood what they could and couldn't do. But an absolute effect, and I think it's a very intentional effect of the anti-immigrant legislation, mm-hmm. and I'm not familiar with the specifics of mm-hmm. it, but it is absolutely to deter people from accessing services to which they should access and are entitled to access. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what is so, unconscionable about the anti-immigrant debate that is occurring nationwide.
But let me just add, I mean, one of the things that can be unfortunate is that because of some of these fears, I mean, ultimately, if you're really, really sick, Mm-hmm. At some point, you will need to seek care. Mm-hmm. There's no avoiding it. What happens is when there are concerns that, gee, this might somehow cause problems for my legal status, what this means is that you'll postpone that care for a longer time period. Mm-hmm. What in many cases this also means is medically, you could have gone and sought care when it was a more trivial problem, mm-hmm. when it's a problem that could be resolved relatively simply, and instead the problem becomes right. more complicated. So in many cases, the states, when they do these things, are to a certain extent shooting themselves or shooting their health care providers in the foot, because instead it means that they're going to see some care postponed, but when mm-hmm. the care comes in, it's a real whopper right. that they're having to bear. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, they may think that they are saving some money. On the other hand, it's not particularly clear that they really are. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about impacts, but before I do, there are a few questions that came in with a focus more broadly on health reform. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to just ask one or two of those. One asks, how would universal health care affect the issue of health care among immigrants, both legal and illegal? Is the population growing so fast that it would saturate that type of system?
Well, it depends on what mm-hmm. how you describe mm-hmm. universal, because universal is often not necessarily universal in fact. And one of the obvious policy calls that's going to have to be made is who will be entitled to access what in a whether it's a single payer or a Massachusetts model, whatever. And I mean, I've seen a number of programs that have been introduced that purport to be universal, which have actually had explicit carve-outs for mm-hmm. populations of undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so I think the real answer to that question lies in the details of how something mm-hmm. is put forth. And you correctly noted at the outset of this program that since its inception, I believe, Medicaid, you know, with certain exceptions in the emergency mm-hmm. context, has tended to exclude from its participation undocumented immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Let me just add, I mean, one of the things, because in so many cases when we talk about immigrants, in so many cases automatically what comes up in people's minds is undocumented or mm-hmm. illegal immigrants. We forget that there are so many legal immigrants as well as naturalized citizens. Sure. So certainly one of the things that I would hope does come up in the agenda as we talk about sort of universal health care, or at least broadening health care, is saying, gee, legal immigrants lost some coverage rights about a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Can't we do something at least to make the system work right mm-hmm. for people who played mm-hmm. Fairly by mm-hmm. all those measures, who are trying to say we're here in the U.S. On a permanent basis and we want to contribute to the system and pay taxes and so on. So that's certainly a part that needs to be strengthened. And hopefully most candidates from either party would try to deal with these issues. I don't know whether that's going to be. We'll see. That remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. The other situation is that there's going to be a problem for uninsured people, particularly the undocumented, no matter what. So one of the things that still needs to go on, that people in some cases don't talk about because they talk so much about insurance coverage, is making sure that the safety net that already exists mm-hmm. continues to be bolstered, that in addition it accommodates itself in the right places. As Tom mentioned, in so many cases, the safety net is really a completely local issue. And so some jurisdictions have pretty good safety nets, some jurisdictions have very weak safety nets. One of the things, actually, that the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured commissioned was a very nice study that showed that many of the areas that had new growth in Hispanics were actually areas that had very weak safety nets, with the net result mm-hmm. that in those areas, it wasn't just Hispanics were having problems getting care. But then, obviously, when they're going to seek care, this means, and the facilities are already overcrowded, it means that people mm-hmm. who are non-Hispanic are also going to have problems getting care. So we need to think about having systems that are more responsive to changes in where the needs of the uninsured population, no matter whether they're immigrants or citizens, and that we need to have that sensitivity in the system to make sure we're bolstering the safety net, too.
Let's talk about health care disparities and the potential mm-hmm. impact of the new policies and the exclusion of immigrants from coverage could potentially have on what we see now. I mean, could things get worse, or are we likely to, is there any impact we can expect?
Oh, certainly. I mean, you look at the prevalence of disparities right now, and you layer onto that policies that either have the design or the effect of deterring access by either immigrants themselves or family members. And the Georgia example really mm-hmm. is an example, I think, of both. Mm-hmm. You are creating a situation where, again, you're having less access to preventive care, less access to specialty care, and the obvious, I think, byproduct of that is going to be exacerbating disparities that already exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition, it's changing the face and the nature of some of the disparities that we see in healthcare. When I looked at the last National Healthcare Disparities Report, my impression, and this is sort of an oversimplification, was that in many areas, the differences between whites and African Americans were getting a little better, mm-hmm. But the gaps that existed between whites and Latinos were getting a little worse. It didn't break out all those differences, mm-hmm. the white-Latino differences by immigrant status, mm-hmm. but you have to think that immigrant status was one of the things that was contributing mm-hmm. to that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in and of itself, immigration may not be the single and only or even the most important factor, but it's contributing to it, and it's one of these things that will continue to contribute, mm-hmm. particularly all the demography says that we should continue to see a growth in the immigrant population in the U.S. over time.
One of our questions mm-hmm. asked about workforce and the fact that many of the medically underserved areas have a large concentration of workers from other countries. And the question is whether or not our change mm-hmm. in our immigration policies will actually affect the availability of health care services in those communities. I'm not sure if that's an issue anyone has looked at, the impact on the workforce, but it is, you know, it is an issue that directly or indirectly could affect access to care.
Without a doubt. I mean, there's already chronic problems of access in rural America and other medically underserved areas, and this is a huge issue in the immigration debate, including not just the debate about undocumented mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. immigration, but the debate about guest worker programs and other programs, the things that are on the table on Capitol Hill. If you're going to expand these programs, then what other requirements should be in place relating to housing, relating to access to health care, mm-hmm. because there are nominally some things on the books, but the reality is you have people working in very, very challenging work conditions, and there's a virtual absence of a safety net for that population.
I think another important thing to think about is that we've mostly talked about immigrants as patients and as consumers, but mm-hmm. actually immigrants mm-hmm. have a fairly important role as healthcare providers. About a quarter of all the doctors in the U.S. are immigrants. About 15% of the nurses in the U.S. are immigrants. So they contribute substantially to the workforce. In many cases, are the people who are actually providing services in rural areas and inner cities where the pay for doctors or for nurses, the conditions right. are not as good. Actually, I remember many years ago seeing a segment on 60 Minutes or one of those shows that featured a doctor from India who was saying he remembered when he was training in India to be a doctor, how he really studied English. He would never have expected at that point that he'd end up being located in West Texas, where the majority of his patients were Spanish-speaking. Mm-hmm. But so to the extent that there are, and this gets into the immigration debate, in many cases there are repercussions for will there be problems for immigrants to be able to come to the U.S. to be healthcare workers. And the answer is that in some cases, if there are continuing problems for those types of work visas to get in, there'll be problems for the patients of those. And in many cases, these are actually patients in rural areas or other underserved areas.
And again, you look at the nursing shortage. Good example. We put together a program for foreign-trained healthcare professionals, mm-hmm. And we did very limited outreach. 200 people show up for this program. They're basically driving cabs mm-hmm. and sweeping floors mm-hmm. right now, but they were trained. As healthcare professionals in their country of origin. 25 people were selected. Mm-hmm. 25 people completed the program. They are now all working in hospitals in the Maryland area. And the challenge, you know, immigration status for them was not, we were able to resolve that issue, but the increasing backlog and you know, the lack of speed in processing this mm-hmm. really does create a host of challenges. And it's really unfortunate because we have these chronic shortages in our healthcare workforce, and we have, it's a much, I think, more effective policy than the morally bankrupt policy of raiding the Philippines mm-hmm. or raiding South Africa.
Right.
But our immigrant mm-hmm. healthcare, the whole debate about immigration status, there's a lot of collateral damage that's occurring right now in the current debate. And part of that collateral damage are people who, if we could just resolve this status issue, we could put them to work realizing their full potential.
Mm-hmm. I want to close with a question that came in from public health director in North Carolina, but it actually asked, I think, the main thing we want mm-hmm. to talk about, and that's the policy choices that we're faced with. But it's clearly a plea for some direction. And the question says, as a local public health director in eastern North Carolina, I'm very interested to hear about the policy choices. We are seeing an explosion of undocumented customers in all of our clinics, prenatal, STD, WIs, WIC, and child health. Many of our laws and systems are dependent on the immigration laws being upheld, which leaves the locals holding the bag and trying to develop ways of dealing with issues that nobody has any guidance for. Despite our pleas, the only response we get from the state is to provide services to all of the new indigent clients with no Medicaid and no federal, state, or county funds. In fact, this new challenge is occurring while many state and local funds are shrinking. What are the policy choices we face?
Are there any easy questions in this program? Well, as somebody who was once, very recently, a local elected official, I very much appreciate the spirit of the question, because the broken immigration policy at a federal level, the absence of a coherent national strategy for healthcare access, ends up trickling down at a local government level on so many in so many different ways. And so I really think that one choice that needs to be made, and I was recently at an event with folks from the Urban Institute who said that if you want to build a robust economy, you need to build an economy, you need to create an atmosphere that welcomes immigrants. That is in the economic self-interest of a state. And I think about the questioner mm-hmm. from Georgia. I think about mm-hmm. the implicit nature of the question from North Carolina. Mm-hmm. One choice you have is, you know, what sort of atmosphere of hospitability are you going to build in your state? I think there is a real danger in some of these local initiatives that are trying to send a message mm-hmm. on immigration. It's very much counter to the economic self-interest of the state. And employers and healthcare providers and local educators and others really need to come together at a local level to say, yes, the system is broken, but we need and we are creating this zone of welcoming, because we all need each other, mm-hmm. as Leighton points out. You know, you look at the healthcare workforce. It's an immigrant workforce. It's an increasingly immigrant workforce. Where would we be without, you know, where would the service sector be, the healthcare sector, the hospitality mm-hmm. sector? Mm-hmm. This is an imperative. We can't, on the one hand, say we need your labor, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, say, but you're not welcome to do anything else. And so I think that's a policy choice, and it's a courageous, it's such an easy issue to demagogue. So I don't mm-hmm. want to tell the public health director that it's going to be an easy thing, but mm-hmm. I think more local jurisdictions need to really buck the tide and look at the demographics and say, where would we be without? There's we do these analysis of costs, but we really should be doing cost-benefit analysis, mm-hmm. because where would communities be without immigrants? I know I've studied that issue, mm-hmm. in my neck of the woods, and the answer is 25% of the tax base in my community is from immigrants. 8% of the tax base in the state of Maryland is from immigrants. Immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, they're playing the lottery right now because they're paying Social Security taxes with no expectation of a return. They get a temporary identification number, and so we need to look at the broader cost-benefit analysis, and we need to build in communities across this country until we get comprehensive immigration and healthcare reform. We need to build these zones where we're saying very clearly that we welcome the change, because change is going to happen, and you can welcome it or you can fight it. And I don't think fighting it's real productive.
Right. Leighton, do you have any thoughts on the policy choices we have?
I agree with Tom on, on much of what he says, but let me add something else to what you were saying, that the letter from North Carolina was saying, was that ultimately part of the backdrop was resources are dwindling in every sector. And that's part of the key, is that, yes, Medicaid dollars in many cases are becoming tighter, state dollars are becoming tighter, and we all know the number of uninsured is going up. I mean, to a great extent, I'd say that many of the problems that are being talked about are not problems related to, per se, immigrants who are uninsured. It's people who are uninsured in general. And we don't have a system that's very sensitive to saying, gee, these are where we need to be putting sort of additional resources. It is ending up catch-as-catch-can, and that's something that we could think about in a more sensitive way, regardless of whether the uninsured patients are immigrants or not. Because I've heard the same complaints coming from people and medical directors in areas where there aren't many immigrants, or where the growth is just generally the uninsured in general. So it's a broader problem than just immigrants. Certainly it's occurring in many areas where they're immigrants, but that's not the full nature of the problem.
No, thank you. I think we'll close on that, because I do think that that this is a broader issue. There are certainly some concerns which are specific to immigrants, but in general, our system, you know, you talked about the need for comprehensive reform, both immigration policy and healthcare, and this is just one of the issues that we need to pay greater attention. Before we close, I'd like to thank both of our panelists, Tom Perez and Leighton Koo, for joining us today. Your insights have helped certainly to deepen our understanding of the issues, the challenges, the policy choices, so I want to thank you for joining us. And I want to thank all of you for your questions and for joining us today. On our webpage, you'll find resources on today's topic that may be useful to you. Again, I'm Marcia Lilly Blanton of the Kaiser Family Foundation.